mostly 50, don't back down. Maybe where I go, both hosts with toast.
All right, my friends. In case anybody needs to know, the year is 2003. Well, they do need to know, because in 2003, I was watching the Dave Chappelle Show. People were listening to 50 Cent. He was blown up with In the Club. And as a country, we decided that it was time to invade Iraq for a huge lie. So no reason at all. And if you were walking around Brooklyn, you probably had a truck driver hat on, skinny jeans, and you were sipping PBRs. It's 2003. And the reason we're covering this year is because we're going to be covering the movie 13 today, which came out in 2003. What up? It's me, Gabe Pacheco, as always. And joining me is...
Sammy Hamarne.
And Sammy, what's this podcast that we do?
Such a good question, Gabe. Thank you so much for asking.
Sorry.
For any new listeners, just a quick breakdown of what we do. Gabe and I like to talk about movies with each other and
that's
other people.
That's all we do.
Yeah, that's it. So basically, we talk about a film, but more importantly, the context of which the film came out, so the year it came out. We break down a little bit of what was happening in whatever year and what was going on in our lives. And then we always have a great guest, some of the best and brightest in the New York City comedy scene, to come in and talk about the movies they love and what they were up to. So basically, we break it down, and
That's that, man.
That's
hell
that.
Yeah! We got a fantastic guest today on mic número tres. We've got the one, the only, Amber Rallo, and you may have read some of her work in Refinery 29 or The Washington Post or Talkhouse, or you may have seen her band Boys Drool all around New York City. And also, she is a brilliant stand-up comedian who will be doing A Week at the Creek the last week in January. And when I say creek, that's the creek in the cave. Great place to get tacos.
Those in the no-no. It's where you play pinball and watch comedy. It's great.
That's right. That's right. It's like the Foot Clan clubhouse from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for comedians in New York City.
It's the orphan clubhouse for comedians, which I particularly enjoy as an orphan.
It is. The island of broken toys.
Yes.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. For all of our Christmas listeners, Feliz Navidad. Hmm. And we're here today because we're going to talk about a movie that Amber picked, right? You wanted us to review 13, which is great. I think I saw it in 2003, but I barely remembered it. So it was a treat to go back and revisit this movie as more of an adult.
I definitely saw it in 2003, but I was in a completely different mindset as I was watching it this time around. In 2003, I was 16 years old, so not too far away from 13. And I was like, yeah, this is so real. This is exactly right. Like, and now as I'm so glad they're being so honest about what it's like to be a teenager. And now as I watch it, I'm like, oh shit, this is really messed up.
Yeah.
This is a messed up. This is really hard to watch. It's very scary.
Well, there was a lot of things happening in 2003 for teens to be, you know, impressed by. Madonna was kissing Britney Spears at the VMA that year.
Ooh,
so, that was then?
Yeah.
Wow.
Passing the torch with lips smacking on lips.
Where has all the time gone?
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's pretty cool. That was kind of like showing some bisexuality on the little screen for everybody.
Hell yeah, bi awareness. Yeah. I love it.
good role models there. Some sex positivity. Oh, Elizabeth Smart, another teen. She was found alive after 9 months of being kidnapped. So this was a bright day for an abducted girl.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that happening.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember. It was?
All over the tabloids.
Wow.
Yeah. People were scared that their little white girls were going to be kidnapped and taken and trafficked.
White girls being taken is a very popular news item.
Sure.
White girls being taken, people take notice.
Yeah, but they made a TV show about her. It was on CBS. It was just a special.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think she was one of the reasons that the Amber Alert system
Oh, hell yeah.
How topical.
How topical. I sometimes get text messages when people get Amber Alerts. It's really fun. People think that they missed a call from me. That's a real thing that happens. I don't know why. I mean, I know why, but I mean, I need smarter friends.
So, yeah, you can thank Elizabeth Smart for those Amber Alerts.
Why was it not a girl named Amber? Why? There's definitely a girl named Amber, too. I'm sure the alert system got better.
I'm sure a lot of Ambers get snatched out there.
Yeah, so. Amber's a very abductable name. For sure.
Also, another fun sort of millennial story there was a hero, 13-year-old surfer Bethany Hampton, jumped right back on a surfboard after getting patched up from her shark bite.
I remember that. That was inspiring. She's like, she's the one-armed surfer.
Soul surfer.
Yeah. And that's hard because you got to relearn your balance completely.
Yeah, your equilibrium is definitely going to be off if you have one less appendage.
Yes.
No matter which one.
She's yoga badass. Class is tough.
Yeah. The tree pose, completely different.
Yeah, warrior one, warrior two.
Oh, my gosh.
What are you going
to
do?
What are you going to do? You have to go directly to one-armed handstands.
But she's a brave hero, Bethany Hampton.
Bethany Hampton.
And also, I don't know where she was from. I assume the West Coast, since she's a surfer.
Yeah, she was definitely a California girl. Yeah.
Or Hawaii.
Could be Hawaii,
too. Could be. Probably Maybe. Hawaii.
Actually, I have no idea, so.
Robert Downey Jr. Thanked Burger King for getting rid of his drug habit. He said he had a meal so bad at a drive-thru that he had sort of an epiphany and was so disgusting and made him rethink his life. So obviously food poisoning.
Wow.
And then drove his car and dumped his drugs in the ocean.
Oh, what a beautiful bottom.
Yeah. Right?
That's very poetic.
There's
love that.
Some sort of joke to be made with the Impossible Whopper now, but I have no tie-in.
Well, I do think that LSD or mushrooms are probably responsible for several people becoming vegetarians. You know, you get a hamburger and you're tripping and you're like, whoa, this used to be a living creature. And you really think about it in a profound new way.
Yeah.
And then decide to, you know, just go for the, carrot cakes.
I once attempted to eat crabs at a crab house on acid.
Oh, that sounds like a terrible idea.
It was actually the worst. And I love crabs, but this was I can't even express to you how
I mean,
that
texture
was.
Is like a very special and unique texture, and having it with the acid. And also then there's like this idea of them biting, like pinching you, and it just sounds all around horrible.
I mean, this sounds like a H.P. Lovecraft short story.
Yeah.
where like you enter the Red Lobster as a teenager and then it becomes like a portal into the realm of Cthulhu where these giant crabs are just attacking you.
Such a good indicator as the fact that your kid's on drugs. My dad was watching me and my friend I was just moving the crab's arms and legs and just staring at it. And he was like, what's the matter? You don't like the crabs? Like, that's not like you. And I was just like, you know, pupils fully dilated.
Right.
Trying to figure out a way out of that one.
He's like, dip the crab in the butter.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's clarified cow's milk. Yum.
Gee.
Yeah.
The word McJob was added to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary for whatever reason.
McJob?
Yeah. Like a McDonald's job, which is defined as a low-paying job that requires little skill and provides little opportunity for advancement. Not a good selling point.
No.
For that type of work, and really kind of belittles anybody that does it. So thanks. Thanks for putting that in there.
Yeah, sad.
What a strange decision.
Yeah.
But this was maybe before Urban Dictionary, like, was a thing, so they didn't...
I feel like Urban Dictionary was around at that time, but I think Merriam's was just trying to capitalize on slang or modern colloquialisms.
They're like, how do we get the kids to buy more dictionaries?
It might have been the Whack Arnold sketch on Chappelle's show that prompted them.
Yeah, McJobs. I can't believe that Disney, or not Disney, but McDonald's didn't sue for defamation.
Any press is good press.
That's true.
Yeah. What could be worse than pink slime?
Hopping into 13, I wonder what Amber was the reason that you chose this for us today?
I don't know. I really liked this movie. I grew up in the Valley. Like I said, I was a teenager when it came out. I had very little parental supervision when I was a kid.
Ran with the wolves.
Yeah, I ran with the wolves. I was wild. I mean, honestly, not nearly as wild as this movie, but I felt kindred to the characters in the movie. And I was like, oh yeah, I knew those people. And I just love the fashion. I like the sweatbands as bracelets and the Hot Topic bracelets, the little like rubber ones that you link together, and Converse shoes, and mesh, and belly button rings.
So you were like Avril Lavigne, basically, in 2003.
Oh, my God. So much eyeliner. So much eyeliner. And a lot of girls have to straighten their hair to do that, but mine is just naturally straight and greasy. So I was, yes.
Where else were you going to go with that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thick belts with lots of studs on them. Yeah, that was fun.
Totally. Well, so this feels like, I saw this when it came out, but like I said, it was a little bit of a blur. And for my generation, maybe I was comparing 13 to the movie Kids, and I saw Kids when I was probably 16, and that affected me, right? Like both positively and negatively. Like I saw the aesthetics of my youth reflected in that movie, and also growing up in D.C., that's like more analogous to New York City. And but watching 13, I figured if I had seen that when I was 16, this movie would probably reflect maybe like that growing up in a city as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, actually, by the time I was 16, I was living in Long Beach. So I had moved from Calabasas to Long Beach. So also I was like having nostalgia for the valley and for like the open space and the weird way that people communicate with each other and the like surfer bro language that's like mixed in with valley girl talk.
Yeah, there is surfing in this. The older brother loves surfing, and his dad, when he comes to visit, is like, hey man, yeah dude, next week we're gonna go to San Onofre, right?
He says Sano, but yeah, he does mean San Onofre. I used to surf at San Onofre. I loved it. Then they had the best breakfast burritos where they put the french fries in it. Very good spot.
Yeah. So where did this movie take place exactly? Not the valley, right?
It was the valley. Yeah.
Oh, it was the valley.
Yeah, it
okay.
was the valley, but I don't know where exactly in the valley.
Gotcha.
Yeah, this movie, the setting is, it feels like a very realistic version of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and a very street level version of it. Like, I know that it takes place on Melrose, and it takes place, parts of it take place in Venice Beach,
mm-hmm.
which are what both we consider West Los Angeles.
Maybe she's in Burbank? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the valley, but I just always thought of it as the valley, I guess.
But they have to drive to all these places too. So her parents, her mom, everybody's driving her around. So I don't know exactly where her house is located. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think it's walking distance from Melrose and that strip.
Greater
yeah.
LA.
Yeah.
Even you need a car to get anywhere.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. No public transportation. Mm-hmm. And they're never on buses. Right?
No. I didn't see a bus.
No, they don't. Yeah. They don't use buses.
They get rides everywhere. Privilege. Yeah. And but this so 13. I thought of this movie. It was a secular version of The Exorcist.
It's
a horror movie.
It did feel no. That's sort of what I when I was rewatching it. I was like, oh my God, this is scary. This is Parasite. Like she is a Evie's character is a parasite, and like really like gets her claws into this family and takes advantage and uses love as a weapon. And I was like, oh, this is scary. If I were watching this as a parent, I would be terrified.
I mean, I've always been terrified of teenage girls, and this didn't help. When I watched it in 2003, I just remember it being like I remember, you know, vividly a lot of the content in this film, because a lot of the drug use was very similar to what we did when we were that age. You know, the LSD in like the acid in the Juicy Fruit packs, we did that. When I huffed computer dust off cleaner and passed out on a car stop. You know, it just
I did that when she says I'm hearing that and I was like, oh yeah, I remember saying that exact sentence.
Classic.
Yeah.
But it wasn't even Whippets, it was straight up dust off. Which is like the stupidest fucking thing. Like, I don't know how many brain cells I killed at 14. But I was just like, womp, 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 womp.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the first time I heard dubstep, I was like, hell yeah. It's just
they put it outside my brain. Yeah. This is what it is.
I'm having flashbacks to things I needed chemicals to perceive earlier.
I'm now ingesting it audibly.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's audible dust off.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's a really good point about the kids' association there, because that's what I wrote down. I was like, it's just like a more modern sort of post-AIDS, like pandemonium LA version of Kids. You know, less on the skate culture and more on the surf culture, obviously, but it's very similar. And kids, when we came out, that movie scared the hell out of me.
Uh-huh.
Like, I was basically, you know, not by choice technically, but abstinent in my mind because, you know, I was scared that my first time, you'd get AIDS. That's basically what they were programming you to
feel like. I'd say both kids and 13 have a more art house aesthetic to them mm-hmm. when it comes to portraying youth culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they, instead of sort of like, let's say movies like Mean Girls
right.
or 16 Candles, you know, like these are not necessarily movies for kids to watch and feel good.
Not even a little bit.
But they, yeah, I don't know who the audience is for these movies.
Us.
Not to say that they're bad. They're not bad. They're like great films.
Right.
But they are, they're twisted.
Yep.
You know?
And you can tell by the funding directly. I mean, this is a $2 million movie, which they shot on mostly on handheld cameras.
Yeah.
The house that they lived in, those girls actually lived in that house for the duration of the film. Like,
yeah.
They decorated it. They did all this stuff. They wore their own clothes.
Mm-hmm.
$2 million budget. Kids was basically like the mother indie film.
I'm actually friends with Evan. We went to mm-hmm. middle school together. And she told me that the budget for this film was like very low. It was very punk rock. It was very much like, let's just throw shit at the wall and see what sticks. Like, let's just try it this way. And she really, really loved that way of working. And then, like, after that, she was kind of a big hit because the movie was a hit.
Right.
And she was suddenly an icon, and she was suddenly doing films that were higher production and very intense and, you know, very much like, okay, redo that same sentence, but instead of telling her, inform her. You know, it's like a very different type
yeah.
of directing. So she didn't like that transition, but...
Yeah, the shooting style in this, exactly. It's like shaky cam, cinema verite. It's got this realism to it because you see, and like you said, the production value, it feels more guerrilla. Like maybe you've got a really small crew. And in that, you've got this opportunity for actors to just really kind of have a grittier performance.
Explore the space.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, and true.
I love
they're
that.
Like, yeah, there's some moments where like, she screams on the street and stuff where you're like, yeah, that was one take. Like, I'm certain of it. She did not redo that because it's
right.
It's too gritty. But and then there is like this very like art house aesthetic to it. At the end, they like change it to black and white.
Yeah.
And there's this like symbolism of this poster. I don't know if you guys noticed the Sybil makeup poster
yep.
that like gets grittier and grittier as you watch it throughout the film.
The character sort of declines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's actually they used Nikki Reed's face, who's Evie's character, for that ad.
It's really unique too that this movie was written and directed by Catherine Hardwicke. And she co-wrote it with Nikki Reed,
mm-hmm.
and Evan Rachel Wood is in it, and so is Holly Hunter. So the writers, the directors, and the prime actors are all strong ladies.
Yeah.
So this is a very a women-centric film, like in that all the elements of it are it's very FUBU.
I feel like they're all I mean obviously based on the budget and what they must have gotten paid to do this,
yeah,
incredibly emotionally invested in this.
Well, Nikki Reed, it's based on her life,
right? That's
like
what
she is playing
that.
Evan is playing Nikki,
yeah,
as her character. So
this movie never would have entered my radar, but at the time that it came out, I was dating someone who grew up in LA. Pasadena, so a bit of a different upbringing.
That's different.
That's a lot different.
Pasadena's cute.
Yeah. So she, you know, was telling me the backstory a little bit about what, you know, who Nikki Reed was, or like, you know, that it was loosely based on her life.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, who knows how loosely? Yeah. I mean, obviously they would know, but yeah. So it was just one of those things that sort of fell into my lap, and it's a jarring watch.
Yeah,
there's a lot to talk about.
Well, we can jump into the setting right off.
Yep.
The movie starts with Holly Hunter plays a mom named Mel who works from home, and she is a black market or gray economy hairdresser who
gorilla
an auteur hairdresser
right.
who works from home, and she has two kids who are teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her daughter played by Evan Rachel Wood, Tracy. and then the brother, who's a little bit older, who's into surfing, mm-hmm. and he's a cool dude. And the house is always full of noise, with clients and 12-step program friends coming in and out all the time. It's kind of a chaotic environment. It's impossible to study at home. It's full of racket. And what happens is Tracy is a sensitive poet who is just reaching adolescence. Like, she's just in the first throes of going through puberty. And the film starts with her attending her first day of school. And I thought that this first day was high school. But what a punch in the guts later in the film when we find out it was her first day of seventh grade.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that because I know, I don't know. I was 14 when I entered high school and I was young for my grade. So I was like, oh, this must be middle school. But yeah, it is. It's young. Yeah. She's young, but also not, it's not that weird. Girls grow up a lot faster and younger, especially in cities.
Yeah. Dude, in cities, in movies, in reality, and we just covered SLC Punk, and that movie is a coming of age story about a dude, and he decides to grow up after college.
Yeah, at 22, which is kind of like...
No, that's actually, that doesn't surprise me.
I also still feel like that's a little bit early.
Right. Like he gets to incubate till he's like 23 before he breaks out of the chrysalis and shows the world that he's an adult big boy butterfly.
Right.
And Evan Rachel Wood's character, Tracy, like, has this rough landing, you know, breaking through the atmosphere into adulthood.
Well, she's
13.
Hurtled forward, I mean, you know, based on her home life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, her home life is hard already, and her mom is this hairdresser who's in the 12-step program, and it feels like she's not there. She's just not there for her. She can't even read the full poem to her. A single mom has like a really super busy life, and then she's also kind of swapped out one addiction for another. She's addicted to the program and like helping people. And,
yeah. She makes a cake for Mario, and she goes, I got to give this cake to Mario today, and we got to go to the program. We got to work it instead of helping
her. It works
her.
If you work it. That's what they say. Yeah, it's very cute. I mean, I myself am in a 12-step program, and I really enjoyed watching that part of it, now being able to see and understand what she was talking about from the mother's perspective. It was really fun to watch.
Yeah. And I feel for the mother. I don't think of her as a bad person at all, but I do see that, she is not, currently capable of, or her priority is helping people and not necessarily prioritizing helping her daughter. Right, because she's going to the 12-step program. She's making cakes for Mario. She's helping her friend who needs to stay with her. And then she hands her friend's daughter off to Tracy to be like, yo, babysitter. And it's like, well, Tracy's got work to do, man.
Yeah.
She's got her own life. Seems she like needs consent to this.
Yeah, Tracy's like, oh, well, it seems like if I'm at home, that means I'm going to have more work to do.
Yeah.
I might as well disappear. Like, it's not, I'm not going to find support here. I should just go and figure out something else to be doing.
So it seems like the mom's obviously stretching herself thin, maybe overcompensating, because when you lose or try to quell one addiction, you sort of fill your time up with
something else.
Endless activities. Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, it's an addictive personality by nature. It's how that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, to Gabe's point, she loves her kids.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, everyone thinks love should be enough, but sometimes it's not. You know, that is a fucking difficult household to grow up in as a 13-year-old.
Love doesn't win.
Yeah.
It's love plus. You need to fortify it with other things like skills.
Or yeah.
And
I mean, her mom. I do want to say her mom like did kind of an amazing job with a really, really, really difficult situation. And her sponsor would probably say something like, you know, she was like putting on her own mask first. She needs to like take care of herself in order to make sure that she can take care of Tracy, and making sure that she stays sober is like the first priority in order to be able to do that. But I don't know. Poor Tracy.
I would feel like that she would have trouble gaining almost sole custody at this point of her kids being in a 12-step program. But
That's what I thought about that too, honestly. And I was like, what's up with the dad? Like, did he not ask for custody at all? Because that must be the case.
Let's talk about the dad. That's a good because he's the only true antagonist in this film, I feel like.
Ugh, he's the worst.
You know, everyone else you sort of, well, with the exception of Evie, but she's so young that you can't be mad at her. Her life is going to be real rough.
Yeah.
But the dad, now, the point that I wanted to make is because he obviously seems like he does have some ounce of care about his children, but is it because he has to pay all these, like, alimony, child support and all this, like, the way his life ended up, that he has to be so fiscally minded at this point that he has no other room to do anything besides trying to make money to pay for
the rest of his life?
You know?
I got the feeling – I mean, he does seem like a yuppie, weirdly. And
It's the hair and the sunglasses.
and that weird little skinny leather belt he's got on his baggy dress pants.
I did not even notice that.
That fancy new car that was maybe like two.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
This is a tool. This is a business tool.
It's a business tool. True. Oh, thank God. I hated him so much. I don't know. I think he wanted to escape this like – I'm sure that the household was hectic when he was there too, and he's overwhelmed by it as well. And his wife was probably already in the 12-step program while he was with her.
Yeah.
And she was already like having these people over all the time and like things happening all the time. And he was like, I don't know, this is too crazy. And so he ran away.
Yeah. I mean, even a guy in the program ran away because it was too crazy.
Yeah, exactly. That's gonna work.
What I really like about this movie is, and we've covered so many at this point, there's so much digging you can do to the backstory to these people and how they ended up. And it's like it almost makes you try to gain some sort of empathy for everybody involved. Like the dad was immediately, I'm like, what a douchebag. Like, but then you think about like what happened, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's like, what was his origin story? I wanted to know what happened before this film because there is a lot of ambiguity to it, you know, where we have – Tracy reading her mother a poem, and that poem feels like there is trauma in it. You know, you're wondering, like, well, is this a poem a confession of her having been molested or having been abused in some way? And was that something that happened with a boyfriend, a mother's boyfriend, or with her father? Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. It does seem like she already went through some trauma before this, before Evie. I mean, she was already cutting herself before Evie got into the picture. So there was something else, and there's still definitely more work to be done.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does make you think about like what else happened. And though I don't know, Gabe tried to ask me about this yesterday about like what was up with the dad's backstory. And I was like, why? So you can blame the mom? And so I immediately got very defensive.
Yeah, I'm just curious. No, I'm not out here trying to blame anybody in a movie. I just want to know the backstory. Like, this father is such a – it's like, well, was he a drug addict too? Is he trying to turn his life around? Is this the first time that he's got a real job? Because his priorities in this are, I need to make this money.
He has a whole other family though.
Interesting.
Did he have kids?
Yeah, he has other kids. Okay. Yeah, they talked about it on the phone at one point.
So
yeah.
No wonder he's grinding.
And was he simultaneously having two families? Like, is he one of these Maury Povich guys?
No, he moved over and chose, like, he started a new family. That's the impression I got.
Like a clean break.
Yeah, he ran away.
So hard reset.
Maybe a prequel, like Steve. Or 43.
Yes.
So, yeah, okay. So we've got like a neglectful father and
absentee.
Yeah.
Absentee father.
You know, but I also get that this like, hey, look, just tell me what the problem is. Look.
I do understand that as a male.
Yeah.
It's just like just tell me what's wrong.
Okay, problem solvers.
Yeah.
But the problem is he wasn't there. Like he is the problem.
Look, Amber, I'm going to come home in about 45 minutes. We've got a 30-minute window of time to solve the problem. Can you please send me a text with bullet points so that I can see what it is that we have to work on? What's the agenda for this meeting?
The problem is you can't be here for more than 30 minutes.
You
like, please.
I'm not going to take this call. You know, I got to take this call.
Oh.
Look, we're still going to
and
the
that
beach
was a
next
test
week, right?
For him when they had that conversation, when Tracy and her dad have that conversation where she's like, you should go. You need this job. And he's like, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And that was a test. I know as a teenage, like having been a teenage girl, he should have said no.
Yeah.
He should have said, I'm not going.
And then he kind of did for a second and then didn't.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I saw him as like, you know.
Well, Nikki Reed says that she regrets now having written her father in such a poor light.
Okay.
Well, Well, no, no, no. I'm not saying anything about Nikki Reed's father. I'm saying this character.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And she, yeah, obviously right. She sees that this character is.
Looking at just the text of the film.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think ultimately that as you age, you sort of gain a little bit of sympathy or empathy for your parents because we're all just fucking hurtling through this world making mistakes left and right. And some of us have kids. So yeah. Like, you can't win them all. But, you know, I'm sure that, you know, she probably understood ultimately that they do love you, or, you know, you would hope.
Yeah.
And they're going to fuck up. And
I also didn't like the boyfriend at first, but then I sort of liked him.
The boyfriend?
Hell yeah.
The mom's boyfriend.
Oh, Jeremy Sisto.
Yeah.
Who was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. He intersects in my life a lot. Like, I bumped into him in New York a couple times. And and when I met other people knew who he was, they're like, that's Jeremy Sisto.
Yeah.
And since that, like last summer, I've just seen him in so many movies now. But before that, he was invisible to me.
This is our second Sisto movie.
Right. Right. And he plays such a cool a drug addict boyfriend in this. Very the more he's in the film, the more I'm like, you know, this guy's got a lot of patience.
Yeah.
He's doing okay.
It's difficult for me to hate addicts for some reason, like, especially if you're trying to better yourself. I mean, like, he was literally trying to better himself. And
sure.
You watch that one cut scene of him hitting bottom, which was rough to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, his intentions seemed good. And ultimately, he had to go because he's like, this place
is making me want to use.
Yeah,
and she understood that as an addict herself. She was like, you know what? Go to your sponsor. Go to Mario. He'll read you the big book.
Yep.
Like,
how good was Holly Hunter, by the way?
Oh, my God.
Jeez.
So good.
I mean, everyone was really solid in this movie. She was incredible, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. She tried as a mom, you know? She was out there buying her buying Tracy clothes.
She ran to the truck on Venice Beach to get the new clothes when, you know, her daughter had like a little breakdown of not having cool enough clothes. That was a really sweet moment.
And she had a really naturalistic performance too. Like this movie has excellent acting in it all around.
Yeah.
And just her at the table, like painting her nails,
mm-hmm,
with her foot up on the table. Everything about their performance.
Of course, you remember that moment.
I do. I'm a
foot fetish weirdo.
can't get enough. Anytime, me and Quentin Tarantino, man, just feet all day.
I knew where that was going.
Sorry, go back to what you were saying about the excellent acting.
Yeah, well,
the more they show the feet, the better actors they are. It's amazing. I just wish people would show their feet more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
continue.
Man.
All day. Love barefoot actors. Mm. So she's just the naturalism. You know, I could totally see her in this house. She really, hid herself, in the character.
Yeah. Speaking of barefoot actors, when her boyfriend came back with the bare feet.
What a crazy scene. I wrote that as one of my favorite scenes in this movie.
Yes. Okay, so her boyfriend comes back after he, you know, he went and talked to his sponsor, or you don't know what he did. And then he comes back and he passes the dad in the driveway.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He's like, nice car.
Yeah.
And then he has the little toy and he makes her laugh. And it's like really sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he came back from a bender and it's the punchline at the end of the entire dad scene. Because he's such a stark contrast
right. To
what you would see on the outside as the
good version of a dad and the bad version of a dad, or like the
good dad with the nice clothes and the nice car is like a total asshole and not able to actually connect. And it made me think too, like, it doesn't matter about being perfect. It just matters that you show up. And like, Jeremy Sisto's like let back in the house, and it's like, hell yeah, this dude's gonna get to put some socks and shoes on. He's probably gonna get a nice meal, a shower, just show up, make people laugh.
He was the only thing even remotely resembling comic relief in this movie.
Oh yeah, he was the lighthearted with that moment with the chicken,
Zen chicken.
Oh, that was beautiful.
That was the first scene when we found out we were gonna cover this. That was the first thing that popped into my head was Zen chicken. He was like, look at his head.
It's not moving. That's a great scene.
It is.
Yeah, and he wins back the teenagers with that scene. Then they have like a family night out.
You know, and
until it gets dark.
That wasn't written. The chicken scene was not written, probably.
Yeah, it was probably just like there was a chicken in this yard that they were shooting in and he grabbed it.
They were like, be free, act.
Yeah.
Hold this chicken. See what happens next.
Yeah, I loved so let's talk a little bit about Evie. Mm-hmm. Our good, our friend Evie.
Short for evil.
So, Evie, poor Evie. She is like the worst representation of an orphan that you can possibly have. She's like doesn't know what love is and has picked up this like way of using the idea of love to like get what she needs.
She is going to ruin a lot of men and women's lives.
Yeah, and that's
the rest
of
her career.
Honestly, I felt like most of the movie. Tracy's character, I felt, had a crush on Evie and was not really doing any of this stuff for, like, the boys that were in the movie, but she was just doing it to be closer and to impress Evie. She wasn't turned on by Javi. She was turned on by Evie watching her with Javi.
Yeah.
She wasn't, like, none of this, you know, it was like the transitive property. None of this was for the boys. She knew that Evie liked to hang with the boys, so then she did.
Yeah, she wanted to do whatever Evie wanted to do. She wanted to emulate Evie's fashion. She was, because she felt that. And I think Evie exudes a seductive quality. So she seduced Tracy.
Yeah.
And she tried to seduce Mel.
Yeah,
she tried to seduce. She's constantly calling mom, mm-hmm. interchanging mom and Mel. So it's like, okay, now, like, are you my friend? Because you're Mel. You're the hot older sister, Mel. But you're my mom, Mel. And then when Mel comes into the bedroom to kiss Tracy goodnight or a good morning, Evie gives her the full-on lip smack and kiss.
Yeah, and she does that to, like, both make...
Yeah.
To make Tracy jealous of both her and her mom.
Very,
it's like
Madonna,
very manipulative.
Britney Spears VMA awards.
It's super interesting. And yeah, there's this scene the very beginning where after Tracy gets her new clothes and she approaches Evie at the lockers, and you see Evie scan Tracy and look at her up and down, and like you see her taking in like the shirt with the angel wings on it and the sweatband and the she has Converse on with a smiley face on it and the low slung jeans, and you see her taking it in. And in that moment, you're like, oh, she passed the test because she gets invited to go shopping. But then later on in the movie, you're like, oh, that wasn't her passing the test. That was Evie sizing her up as a possible new victim.
Yeah. She's like the old vampire in Let the Right One In, looking for the next servant.
Exactly.
Both of these actors played vampires later on.
Oh yeah,
Nikki Reed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. In what? Twilight.
True Blood.
True Blood.
True Blood and Twilight.
And
yeah.
Twilight.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, how about that? Vampires big in the early aughts.
Yep.
That's true.
She is a Evie is a true survivor and an agent of chaos. Mm. You know, she knows exactly what buttons to push to leverage people to get what she needs from them specifically. But she also triangulates relationships so that she creates beef and tension between others.
I mean, I wasn't this manipulative by any means, but I would say as a fellow orphan, there were like times where I, you know, nobody picked me up from school. And so I would go to a friend's house, and I knew exactly how to work the parents to make the, they loved me. They wanted me around all the time. I could definitely have moved into any of their houses. There's this, like, I knew how to say just the right amount to make them feel bad for me, but also be like, oh, you're so put together for how messed up your house is sort of energy.
Yeah. Because you're got to impress the parents and not have them see you as a threat, a toxic agent in their own child's development, you know?
Yeah, it's a balance.
I thought, like, when you're a kid, you can hang out with anybody. It's this weird period of time where class does not play into things because you don't have jobs yet. So you can hang out with, like, the kid from the broken home. Like, all, you know, there's kid culture. And I think it happens during that magic hour between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. That Matt, if you have unstructured free time, if you're not on track, if you're not in the science club, you're home, your parents aren't home yet, you're hanging out with kids from the wrong side of the tracks, the wrong apartment complex, everyone's cutting up Swisher sweets.
That's when I smoked my most weed, was right after school before dinner.
Yeah. and then when you have to go home to dinner, or you got to go home because of curfew, everybody goes to their own houses, and you have no idea what basement hovel your friends live in. Mm-hmm. You know,
especially if you're from a huge city.
Yeah. So there's Evie. Is that, you know, the parents don't even know who mm-hmm. what the background of their friends, their kids' friends are. You know, we only see where Evie lives, and like the extreme, like degenerate nature of her own, her guardians, the unstable environment her guardians yeah. create for her, halfway through the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, Evie.
But I do. Like we said earlier, I feel for Evie. Like, she is not, she didn't choose this life. She's surviving based on what she's already gone through. Like, she needs to, honestly, she, like, probably needs to sell drugs in order to make money, in order to keep herself fed. She's, like, yeah.
Yeah.
She's not in a good situation.
And she has burn scars on her back. She's been hurt, traumatized and hurt physically and emotionally, and she's definitely not a villain to me, but she is. She's an antagonist in the story, mm-hmm. but she is also, it's like, man, she just needs intense therapy as well.
Yeah, you know? She's going to take a while to get better if she ever does. She like has to like white knuckle her way through this like adolescent phase. And then hopefully maybe when she turns 25 and her brain fully develops and she like gets empathy, then she'll understand that what she was doing was wrong. But yeah. She doesn't have right now. Like, you need someone at this point in your life as a teenage girl to like, you need someone to tell you, treat people nicely. And if nobody tells you that, it's like, it doesn't come naturally.
Oh man. So I taught middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And I always tell people the hardest year to teach is 7th grade. People think high school is where the problems are. No, man. 7th grade is wild. Because 6th grade, the kids first show up into the middle school. So they've got that fresh fish, like, prison thing going on where they just act. They still are kids, you know, and they are scared of the adults and they want to do the right thing. 7th grade, there's no consequences. Because you're not going to high school the next year. 7th grade is all the chaos of puberty. It was the time that I saw girls fist fighting with each other in the hallways.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, all of the bad sex stories were – that was when all the bad stuff yeah. was going on. And then 8th grade, most of the kids are excited to go to high school. So they're thinking – they're starting to
think about their future.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, I need to – sort of start to take things seriously.
And what else is happening? They're also given the responsibility of being the elders within the community. So they take on the role of kind of being big brothers or sisters and role models. And this is like, you know, I'm just speaking in absolutes. So this isn't everyone's experience. But 7th grade was the wildest year.
Yeah. Everyone's sort of discovering themselves, or at least their sexuality for the first time. So the pressure on both sides is crazy. That's interesting that you said girl fist fights, because that's when I saw the most girl-on-girl fist fights in my life.
Right,
down the hallways of you know, my junior high school, which was like a big city high school.
Yeah.
Lots. And they were the most brutal fights.
Dude, savage outbursts. Well, when guys punch each other in the face, like once you lose, it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And then you're done.
Oh, man, these girls are going at it.
Yeah. And there's vendettas, revenge, scratching, trying to deface people.
Yeah, there's nails. You have jewelry. Like, you better take your hoops out. If not, that's dangerous. There's hair to pull. Like, it's a lot. It's no, girl fights are bad. And yes, they were in middle school. 13 was like the year that there were so many out on the field. Like, just, and it took my middle school was very, very large. Like, I feel like there was only one middle school in the valley that everyone went to, which is weird. I had to like bus like 45 minutes to get there. And it took a really long time for any like teacher or anything to get to a fight.
Yeah.
Like there's much time where things could go wrong.
Well, we had we had security guards and we had police. This is a big DC school. I think our student body at Alice Steele, 7th and 8th grade, was like 4,000 or 5,000 people.
Yeah.
So those fights were, they were governed, kind of. But it was like a yard. It was like the prison yard, literally, like our blacktop.
That was more like my high school in Long Beach. That's where it was more like first very school. Quick, very like, yeah. It's yeah.
We were the first school in the country to get metal detectors, I think.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I was in an all-boys school where I had to wear suit coats and turtlenecks, and we were drawing comic books.
So who's the fish?
real civilized though. I was very soft and protected.
Aww.
No calluses on my chubby little kid fingers.
My high school, we did have to wear uniforms. We had to wear white or maroon collared shirts and khaki bottoms, but that's because the gang violence in the neighborhood was so bad that they had to stop allowing kids to wear whatever colors they wanted.
They were like, what's the one color none of the gangs want to wear? Oh, maroon? Let's do that. All right, Maroon 5, get
in
here.
That's honestly, orange. I thought was like a dangerous idea that they like went so close to red.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Byproduct of the society. I think, the metal detectors were because D.C. at that time was the murder capital, so they obviously had to do it. We had George Bush come and visit, and then they just left the metal detectors in for the rest of the year. Forever, actually.
Yeah, that was was the sneaky way that they did it.
That was very, very smart of them, honestly.
It really was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved one of my favorite scenes in this movie was them tripping in the park.
Yeah.
That was so that to me was so cool, like, because that's that magic hour, 3 to 7.
Yeah.
But you don't want to take any drugs during that magic hour that aren't going to wear off for 24 hours.
Yeah,
or that you can't fake it. Like, she was obviously a noob in that she, like, couldn't act right when she got home.
Yeah. And that the camera work there I thought was so perfect. Her acting was so good.
It was so good.
Because that reminded me of what it was like to be on acid when I was a kid. I made the mistake of doing acid at school in the winter, which is like the worst idea when you're 15. It's like, if you think you look at the clock a lot normally, you know, to see what time class ends, you would do that.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's torture. That is.
Yeah, that is. I can't think of a worse context. You're like, okay, it's cold outside, so I'm trapped.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get cabin fever while I'm tripping. And I can hear the clock on the wall ticking.
Yep. That's exactly what it sounds. Yeah, it still sounds like
and
that.
And there's nothing fun to stimulate your brain. Man, oh man. And that's why California is probably the coolest place to be a high school kid.
I was going to say. It's like East Coast summer all year round.
Yeah. I was getting that nostalgia for summertime. Yep. Watching them laze on the lawn. Like, I could smell fresh cut grass.
Oh man, I
could
miss it.
Feel the pollen in the spring and like feel the sun on my face. And I kept thinking, oh man, this would be the best time right at 3 o'clock to just like roll up a joint and take a bus to Venice Beach and just hang out all day, call my parents, whatever, tell them I'm at the library like they did. Probably not get a tongue ring, but watch some other people get tongue rings. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I liked that. I liked that scene a lot. It was very that one. I was like, okay,
been there.
Yeah,
nostalgic. Yeah, love it. But
yeah, tripping in Glover. I tripped in Glover Park. I remember tripping at the zoo and coming home and having some friends where I was like, you can come in. You have to leave. You're a liability.
Yeah,
I didn't do acid until I was in college though at Berkeley and like in Dolores Park in San Francisco. Or like, you know, I don't know. I remember being 17, just going into college in Berkeley and finding a bag of things, a bag of drugs, and doing them.
Like just a gift bag?
Just found it. I found it in the park. We found drugs in the park and we did them. It was so dangerous. And
suspect behavior.
We were told it was Molly. I mean, I mean, also like 16, my dad passed away that year. Like,
I would have done the same thing regardless of my situation.
I was not a smart teenager. I was a lucky teenager. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
I stopped doing all those drugs by the time I got to college.
Good.
I'd done acid and mushrooms so many times as like a youth.
Yeah.
That I was like, I'm all set.
You're like, I've really gotten into IPAs.
Yeah. I'm just going to go try. She got this whole learning thing.
Yeah. I'm going to be, what is that called? The dry boys who are like extreme. What are they called?
Straight edge.
Straight edge. Yeah. I want to be straight edge.
Oh, man. But there's that scene. You know, and even them tripping in the park before they're, like, this movie feels like a Just Say No commercial. And I don't feel that way, though. I was pushing back where I saw them tripping in the park, and I was like, well, maybe they're too young to do it, right? It's seventh grade. But at the same time, it was like, it seemed like they were having a great time in the sprinklers until her older brother calls her and harshes her mellow. Like, oh, it just sucks that this is when you decided to do this. it sucks that you're tripping now when you have to get home and have dinner. Like, you should have just scheduled your day better.
Right.
Pick a day where you've got 12 hours free.
You've always got that come down moment.
Well, like, her mom, so you think about, like, her mom watching her go through this situation, and, like, it's, she knows that her daughter is getting high. Like,
right.
She
absolutely
knows that her daughter is doing drugs. Like, she is in a 12-step program. She's very aware. And there is this, like, logic in the program where you have to let everyone have their journey and everyone find their own bottom.
To an extent.
And, like, yeah, to an extent. Right. So she was, like, letting her for a little bit, even though she could clearly see what was going on.
Well, if you take, like, the totalitarian approach and just condemn it outright, then it's going to cause, you know, probably my parents were more along those lines than they were, you know, even though they weren't that bad. But they, you know, they have an idea. It's like you can hide smoking cigarettes from a parent who's a smoker, but you can't hide doing drugs from parents who are addicts. Right. That's my guess, right? It's like, I smoke cigarettes. We did ask, but they would have no idea. At least my parents didn't. But her mom knew. And you kind of, like, you know, she's a teenager. Mel was Sisto's line. And that's kind of where he was just like, let it go for a minute.
It's interesting because I think that it's not the drugs that's the problem. It's who you're doing them with.
Well, yeah.
And so, like, the red flag is like, oh, man, you're getting – like, you do acid with somebody and they are they're like a normal person.
Yeah.
Then it's going to be fine. You don't do acid with Charlie Manson.
Right.
Right? Like, you don't do drugs with Evie. Like, the mom should have been like, the red flag is Evie.
Right.
I don't know. I would push back against that, actually. I would think that it's actually Tracy who is the wrong person to be doing drugs, knowing that she is already self-destructive.
Yeah,
sure.
Knowing that she's already cutting herself, knowing that she comes from a family history of addiction. Like, she is the one who's not in the right mindset to be doing drugs. Like, she needs to be getting help before that.
Right.
And unfortunately, well, she already needs to be in therapy. So she doesn't have this, like, magical... She doesn't have this... She doesn't have that magical childhood moment because she is already past that.
I think Evie is the gateway drug in this film because everyone has that friend that sort of triggers your own wild side. And we all have it in us, you know, especially at that age. You're testing boundaries left and right. You're doing everything you can to sort of prove yourself or just to test your limits and what you're capable of doing. And so Evie is what, you know, it's not the drugs, because we've all done drugs here and we're all, you know.
Yeah, but I think what Amber's getting at is that Evie was already teetering. I mean, Tracy's already teetering.
Oh, agreed.
Because she has none of the foundation to have a stable personality.
Oh, and she's not doing drugs for the right reason. She's not doing drugs like to have fun. She's doing drugs purposely to hurt herself. Like, she wants,
right.
That's what she's after.
I absolutely agree with that point. It is, she's a troubled candidate for drug use.
Yeah. I guess not even within this film, but because the film portrays drug use as almost always bad.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to push back against that.
Yeah.
To say that drugs are not always bad.
Yeah. No, usually they're not. Depending if they're used correctly, they're great. That's why they're illegal.
Right. Right. 100%.
Because the right people aren't getting paid according to the government. That's why they're illegal.
Everyone
uses it as a form of escapism. Maybe when I said that was the wrong term. But I mean, I agree with Amber's point completely. Like, certain people, you know, are prone to A, addiction, or B, you know, tremendous depression. It's like watching an alcoholic kill himself drinking. It's like, you don't, you know.
Sure.
Some people just can't enjoy it correctly, so.
Yeah, maybe
it's okay,
one day
but
we'll.
Being sober is great too, so you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pick a lane, you know?
One day we'll cover Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah, God, that's going to be great. That should just be us in a dark room drinking peppermint schnapps and one of us throws up.
I do agree that Evie was like the gateway drug.
Yeah,
like, definitely. Like, yeah, I had a friend who, like, I had a crush on, and, like, she was very seductive, and she, like, wanted, you know, she was the one who, like, got us to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
And, like, got it. Like, she was the one who, like, first had me smoke pot. I didn't know. I don't know. I wasn't as enamored with her as Tracy is with Evie, and I just cut her out of my life myself because she was kind of like, she had, it was this girl named Brittany, and she had like four of us other girls, like her underlings, And she was bossing us around a lot. And finally, I was like, oh, I don't want to be bossed around. In fact, like, you other ladies, like, girls, you shouldn't be bossed around either.
Yeah.
And we sort of broke up the group, and then Brittany didn't have any power anymore. She wasn't as good as she wasn't as good at it as Evie is.
There's always such a hierarchy within the girl cliques at that age. It seems like in high school, there's always like a pecking order. It seems like there's like an unquestioned ringleader, and then like everyone sort of trickles down to a certain role. But like they're more on the same level when there's just one person. Like I felt like in the male dynamic, it was different back then. Like I'm still friends with the same kid that I smoked cigarettes and pot with for the first time ever.
Right. There was, you know,
who introduced me to him.
Yeah.
There's no criminal organization pyramid.
Right.
Where there's only one Tony Soprano who gets knocked out.
Yeah.
So basically you're saying that teenage girls have a structure that's more like the Sopranos.
It fits more structured.
Yeah.
It seems like than the male one.
Yeah, well, you think about it, like we use like color coded gel pens, so we're very organized.
Yeah, that guy's parents don't pay attention. We'll go to his house.
Yeah, exactly.
You're the leader. Yeah. I'd rather have you drinking beer on my property than drinking it out in public. Like,
yeah,
we like you, dude.
You do.
You're our favorite.
Yeah, my man's got a pool table. Nice.
You're super cool.
That made me think of the other girl, the blonde that Evie is friends with at the very beginning that she goes shopping with, and then
Astrid, maybe.
Astrid, I think. Yeah, she gets like knocked off because Tracy takes her place, and then Tracy sees her later in the bathroom, and she's like putting gems on her eyes.
That's the one.
And she's
Oh,
do you want to go sell shit on Melrose? And this girl is like, no, actually, in biology class we're having a presentation, and I'm the mermaid. And I was like, oh, wow, without Tracy in her life, this girl thrived. Like, she suddenly is having, like, a really good life, and she's into school.
Yeah.
And, like, Tracy did her this huge favor by taking Evie off of her hands.
Yes, yeah, it's Evie.
It's more like – it feels a little bit like the horror movie It Follows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that it's – well, I've got this demon that's on me, and you got to pass the demon along. And so Evie hops from the first girl to our girl Tracy.
Yeah, she needs a new carrier.
Uh-huh. Because she's a parasite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the second time we've mentioned
parasite. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she is a parasite. She's like a freaking
absolutely
cuckoo bird. She's like trying to,
She is so scarily manipulative in this movie that I don't think there's any rebounding. Like, once you're that way, you'll never not be that manipulative ever. It feels almost impossible to come full circle.
Behavioral cognitive therapy?
Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy. But
word.
Yes. Yeah. Cognitive behavioral therapy when she turns like 25. I think she could possibly be okay.
I mean, you have to.
But it's like a lot. It'd be a lot of work.
If she gets anywhere past 30 with that same mindset, that's curtains. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I think Evan, Rachel Woods, Tracy is such a cool character.
Yeah,
and as an actor, she did such a great job portraying at the beginning the nice, responsible, sensitive girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she's able to play so young and play, and she's like a poet,
right?
And she's got like a bunch of nerdy friends. The Asian kids that all do science projects together.
Yeah.
That's
Vanessa
awesome.
Vanessa Hutchins.
and then her ability to go through a range of behaviors and really go Looney Tunes crazy in some scenes.
It's kind of amazing how much the clothes shift her into a completely different person. Like, what would like a 13-year-old boy wear? Like a suit? A suit and tie would be the only thing, the only equivalent of like that drastic of a makeover, you know, aesthetically, and just like your entire personality would shift. Golden Globe nominated for this role, which is, I mean, she did an awesome job. I felt like I was on drugs for a minute or two there.
Yeah, but the like punching each other, doing the dust off, and then that was a riveting scene.
Yeah,
and really set the tone for the whole film.
Yeah,
but also the one thing that I have such a hard time watching on screen is cutting. I can't.
Yeah,
I've like
I don't,
written that
yeah
in my notes with like with all cap letters and exclamation points.
Absolutely,
it's just so hard to watch.
Needles for me and cutting. Cutting is really tough to watch.
You know, it's hard to watch. I unsuccessfully tried to cut myself when I was a teenager.
Yeah, it's like I can't even handle paper cuts.
No, yeah, actually, yes, unsuccessfully. I broke this mirror and I tried to do it and it just like wouldn't, it just wasn't
sharp
enough.
Did you cut yourself on the broken mirror?
Yeah, I tried. No. But it wasn't sharp enough. It was like this hand. It just like scratched. It wasn't good.
That sounds awful.
I know.
Holy smokes.
I had a weird like, I mean, I definitely went through depression. I still am dealing with depression. I went through depression when I was this age. There's actually this memory I have of being really depressed and sitting outside a windowsill on the second story of our house and like crying. And my parents weren't home, but my sister Brooke was home. We were at home alone from a very young age, and I must have been like 10, and I was sitting there and I was like thinking about jumping, but I knew that it was not high enough of a jump. It just wouldn't possibly do anything besides break a bone.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that sucks. Like, that's not going to work. And my sister came and saw me, and she like ran back, grabbed the Polaroid camera, and came back and took a photo of me sitting there because she wanted to tell on me once my parents got home. That was her reaction.
Snitch mode.
Yeah, I can't believe
it. And that's like, yeah, I don't know. We didn't have empathy yet.
No, I get that. And that's, you know, maybe you've totally answered my question for me before I was going to ask around Tracy's brother in this. Because he's only like a couple years older. And I would think, you know, I had a younger brother and I always thought that, okay, well, if I'm doing something, I want to tell him enough about what I'm doing when I think he's responsible enough or like maybe going to be going through the same thing to like help him. Mm. And I would think that her older brother, like what was their relationship? Because they could have been getting high together or he could have been telling her about the times that it didn't go so well for him.
Yeah.
You know?
It seemed like he wasn't taking her under his wing,
right?
Really. And I feel the relationship that you have with your younger brother, it feels like the relationship that I have with my little sister. Like, I would tell her exactly what was happening and like help her move through so she had more information than I did. But, you know, some siblings don't have that. Like, I didn't have that.
I feel like at that age, too, that you drift apart as siblings more because you have your own social circles. And especially if you're a couple of years apart or, in this case, different genders, like, you're going to have less of the same. So, and you're just branching out. You're figuring out your own thing. My brother was 5 years younger than me. And I obviously wouldn't – and I smoked a lot of weed in high school and like, junior high school. I just knew that I wasn't going to be the one that introduced him to it or, like, supplied it for him. But we could hang out and talk about it all we wanted. But I didn't want to be the one that brought it into that. And, you know, the
introduction. Yeah, totally. Oh, I'm totally not saying that
He found it on his own, as they all do. As
yeah.
Everyone does.
But more like instead of being an older parent, mm-hmm. being like, hey, man, slow your roll.
Yeah.
You know, that's the lane. But I don't even know what I'm saying. Like, it didn't matter what I did. My brother still, like, skipped school all the time. Wild. So
that's all natural. I mean, I came home, you know, a couple of years later after my brother was in 7th or 8th grade, and him and his friends were saying they were smoking a ton of weed in my parents' house. Something that I never had the balls to do. I was like, what the fuck is going on?
In the house, yeah.
In the house.
Yeah, I think.
Secret Service, right in the alley.
Sure.
Yeah.
Dude, I remember smoking weed in D.C., like a couple blocks from where I lived, and there were all these – there's embassies everywhere, and you don't know. It's just a house, but it's like the embassy of Tanzania.
Right.
And if you're out there before weed was decriminalized in the city, it's like now – secret police would like run up on me.
Right. Oh, well, we had one of my brother's very good friends was a son of a vice president at the time. So he was also smoking weed in our living room. And I was just like, this is bad.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Democrats.
Yep. That was my whole thing with the drug introduction to a sibling.
Sure.
I'm not going to give it to you your first time. We can talk about it and smoke weed later. But mm-hmm. I just didn't want to be that guy.
I love the idea of you unzipping your book bag and inside a bunch of pamphlets. And you're like, hey, check it out. Here's some information if you want about the drugs that you're using.
I know I just got kicked out of Catholic military school for selling weed, but I'm going to tell you a little something about, you know, life. Chief.
All right.
All true stories. Good times.
Evan, there are a couple things in this film. I loved the last 10 minutes where Tracy, played by Evan, who I'm like sympathetic with the whole time, she gets rid of Evie. from, they send her back to live at her guardian's house. And
they're going to move. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
This is before
that. Yeah. All right.
Now this movie for 10 minutes becomes a teen psychological thriller that I would have loved to see as a horror movie on its own, where it's Evie is now spreading gossip about Tracy. So like she's saying that Tracy's like made out with people in stairwells. She's getting her in trouble with like the two black middle school kids.
Oh yeah.
And
she's leaving her on, like, she's not allowing her to come out to shop with them anymore. Like,
yeah,
she's not in the club anymore.
And then what else has she done? Oh, and then she frames Tracy for all of these drugs and cash that's in the house.
Yeah, that was crazy. And that's, she tells her, she says this a few different times in the movie, is I love you. People that say I love you too much don't love you. Either you show it or shut the fuck up.
I say I love you a lot. Yeah.
I love you,
Sammy. Love you.
I don't know how to take that.
Right. It's like, well,
but it can be used as a weapon, and she definitely uses it as a weapon.
This way, obviously.
Yeah. What's your love language? Is it professions of faith or love, or is it gifts? Is it service?
Or is it? I'm just going to pin all these crimes on you.
Right. That's how I should.
I love you. Go ahead, take the stash. Take that.
Yeah. If you take the fall for me, that means you really love me. And that is that's a messed up scene, and I feel like that could be its own film, like a teen single white female.
Yeah, and then then Evie's guardian and her, Brooke, and her move to Ojai.
A spiritual place north of L.A.
Yeah, it's like a little hippie town.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. It was like north of the city.
Yeah, mm-hmm. My sister lived there for
like
a while.
Slovang or some shit.
Yeah.
It's like full of yogis and...
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Farming yogis and in sort of turquoise jewelry.
Mm-hmm. Right. I have one quick question that I didn't really pick up on. So Evie calls Brooke, who her guardian. He calls her guardian, her cousin, and her...
Aunt.
Aunt.
She is her aunt.
Right.
But she calls her cousin because Brooke doesn't like to come off as too old.
Oh, right.
It's like a grandma being like, don't call me grandma.
It's weird because it's all different... instances in the film too, like different time periods. Like in the very beginning, the first time she mentions her, she says guardian, then she says cousin, I think, and then aunt finally. Mm. Right.
Yeah. It almost sounds like the Joker's origin story.
It's like peeling back onion layers.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's like, where'd you get your scars, Evie? And she's like, from my aunt. I mean, my mom. I mean, my cousin. I mean, Tracy.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Which one is?
One of her best. Right. Evie's best line in the film is when she's like, "Look, I'm here every day. I'm trying to make this work.
Right. I'm making it better every day." And you're like, "Whoa, no, you
like
are not."
Little things from that Star Wars movie or Star Trek where they put in Spock's ear, like those little like bugs. It's basically she's infested. She's nesting.
Oh, you know how they did? You remember the scene where they were taking the frozen spoons and putting them under their eyes?
Yes.
To get rid of the bags under their eyes. I used to do that as a teenager. As a teenager, why are girls so like getting obsessed about age and looking old and tired?
I mean,
how can you
blame them? It's literally shoved. I can't even.
It's like shoved down your throat for sure.
It's
but
unreal.
It's,
the one thing I took, like, immediately I was like, women have it so much harder in society, just in general, right out of the gate. Like, everything is pressure. Like, I mean, you know, men face, or kids, boys face so little pressure comparatively at that age. It's unreal. Like, all they're doing, she's like, she wants to go out and do acid, and this dude's trying to make out with her. All these idiots are busting completely unwarranted beatbox freestyles. Which are the worst thing ever.
They're so bad, right?
That would turn me off anyway. That shit
cheesy
is like,
as... Oh, my God. That Tracy.
Yeah,
I'm like,
he was like, right, dog. What about touching my dick now?
Oh, like, I hate it. Oh, I hate it so much. Oh, I hated all of that. I was like, you are so bad.
You know, I love hip-hop, but there's nothing more uncomfortable than that. It's like the worst thing ever. But yeah, it's just like you see this – you don't even see – I mean you see it as, you know, being handsy and like just like actually going after some sort of sexual anything. But it's just – it's not – it's subtle. But it's always there. It's like omnipresent no matter what happens. Like the guy in the fucking – the guy with the lean.
The guy with the lean.
Yeah, he's like, you lost? You want to suck my dick?
It's like, Yeah, yeah. Let's go fight. Want to suck my dick? God, stop it. Sorry,
dicks
Mike,
coming
yeah.
at you from everywhere.
Right, right, right. That's like all, that's all. That's always the period at the yeah. end of the sentence. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Like, hey, you want to work on SATs together? We'll study. Suck my dick.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, like looks like you need to go to the ER. You've got a pretty bad cut. I'll help you with that. Suck my dick.
You're right.
Probably going to need something back.
It's like, God.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it is exhausting and very real. It was a good portrayal. Well, I was like, right. Like... And it's like, and it's very, it's weird at that age. It is like you turn like 12 or 13, whatever age it is. You suddenly wake up one day and you are a sexualized object. Like yeah. just like. It's so sudden. It feels, I remember having that feeling of like, whoa, like people are looking at me different. It's really off-putting and sudden.
Yeah, I can imagine. And also not all guys
no.
are like this.
Oh, of course. You know what
I mean? I mean, 13-year-old boys are definitely more sexually aggressive than.
And that dude that had the lean and like propositioned her, that was a fully grown man.
That was a man.
He
was at least 17.
No, he was
18, 19.
Cornrows, beard, yeah. white guy.
Riff-raff.
Yeah.
yeah.
I actually kind of got a lot of Spring Breakers in that one scene.
Uh-huh.
Like that vibe.
Yeah.
Catherine Hardwicke, one thing that I read was that she changed the lighting for all the scenes just based on the mood of the film, which she did. And it really actually – you don't even notice until you actually read that it was done, but it made such a difference.
Yeah, the lighting is more like the scene muted. Where... Until Evie shows up, and then when Evie shows up, the lighting becomes much more vibrant because it's the internal,
right.
the emotional state of Tracy is like, oh, now like the world is vivid.
Yeah, and where I thought she did it best was the Holly Hunter shower scene because it was like dark but a little bit bright in the background, so it's like a sort of an arc. Yeah, just a really well shot movie on handheld cameras.
Yeah,
no less.
Yeah, guerrilla style.
I love it. Guerrilla everything.
And. Well, I would Holly Hunter, so good in this.
Yeah.
You know, Evan Rachel Wood, the best for me, I wrote this in exclamation points. How did Holly Hunter never notice the tongue ring? The whole movie, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop because she gets the tongue ring. And when somebody gets a tongue ring, you can't talk for days.
Right.
You're chewing on ice the whole time. And I just could not, like, every scene I was waiting for Holly to be like, wait. What's that shiny thing in your mouth?
Teenage girls, you can get away with not talking. It's like you're sullen and angry anyway, so it's fine. It's fine. Nobody thinks much of it. I wasn't surprised that she was able to get away with that.
Yeah.
Personally. I don't know.
Yeah.
Especially because her mom's very preoccupied with a lot of other things. Like, sure. Her mom's distracted. Her mom can't even listen to her poetry, so like... She didn't notice.
It's true.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
She noticed the belly button rang quicker.
That's right. She did.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Well, what a fun movie about burgeoning criminality as well. Because I thought, well, there's no one there training parents on how to deal with your child once they start shoplifting. Lying pathologically, burning bridges with all the neighbors.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you get an ex-con, like a scared straight ex-con, to come into the apartment and yell at the kids?
You've got to figure out a way to sort of, you know, provide some sort of structure in their lives there, in like a home environment where it's not, you know, basically like a transient, like a train station's worth of people just transitioning in and out, and just a more stable. Space where they can relax and be at home and work and do what they have to do. I mean, you know, as good as, you know, as loving a mother as Holly Hunter's character is, Mel is, she's got like a fucking train station full of addicts coming in and out of her house all the time.
Well, what we're looking at too is like just poverty, man.
Right.
Like, what can you do if you have, she needs to work.
Right.
And the easiest way to work and also maintain the house is to work from home.
Right.
So having clients come into the house is the only way to really do that.
Right.
And, you know, because you can't let's say she worked outside of the house, she would have to generate enough income to have a babysitter at home.
And also enough income to rent a chair. Like, right. It cuts into your profits if you have to work from a salon.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. And she's also a hairdresser, which there's this, like, connection between like therapy and hairdressing, and like when you're that close to someone, you're kind of like a friend when they're your client. Yeah. It's a therapist. Like it's the very
therapist.
Yeah, I used to work in a salon. I know, like that's people get that's very really attached to their hairdressers. So that'd be really hard. And she's building a client base through like her friends and through the program, which is like the right thing to do. But it's really hard. I think she made the right decision to get Evie out of the picture. Like that was absolutely necessary. And it was hard for her to do because Mel has boundary issues and is like a pushover and obviously can't say no to sob stories. It's like she's a Captain Save an Orphan, you know?
Right. She takes in all the strays.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like that one woman that comes in with her young daughter, who's also like, you've got to feel for that younger daughter, which is like a glimpse into the future. It's just like, she's like, oh, I need to crash for a couple of days. I think I might have diphtheria. I'd be like,
yeah, I'm really? Just going to let my dog and great. My little girl pee in your bed.
Yeah. Or which one? We don't know which one peed. I'm assuming it was the little girl. Dogs are pretty good about not peeing.
That's true. Yeah. Well, yeah. So the movie ends with, ambiguously as well, with Evan, Rachel Woods, Tracy screaming. While she's on that like merry-go-round.
What do they call those things? I'm trying to remember the name of that.
Oh my god!
It's a car sickness toy.
It yeah.
Just, if you're on that thing spinning too long, you just
them.
Vomit.
They were yeah. so much fun.
Right. Especially in high school, right after you smoke a joint at between 3 and 7, the magic hour.
So symptomatic playground. For life, just spinning.
Yeah, and she screams, and it reminded me of like Michael Myers in maybe the Rob Zombie remake. Mm-hmm. Just like, like is this the origin of a villain? Or what's going to happen to Tracy next? Is she going to go to rehab and clean it up, or is this the beginning of her criminal career?
It reminded me more of little, like classic little girl stuff. I was like, yeah. Oh, she's like back to like being a little girl.
I thought that's what like, I got out of it too.
My niece, we like went to go visit my sister and brother-in-law, and my niece is 11. And at one point, like we were having a conversation and she didn't like what I was saying. And she just straight up screamed in my face. Yeah. Like not words, just like, and I just looked at her and then she like calmed down and like, went back to normal. But like that's a very little girl, like suddenly my emotions are
I got the sense that it would be okay. I think ultimately she had that mom, and you know, even though her dad is absentee, like, you know, she had a support network that Evie didn't have. Evie had like a completely, I don't even know what to say about Brooke's character, but disenfranchised, scary, delusional a little bit.
Sure, but she'll, you know, there'll be like a little, there'll be an ashram type situation for her in Ojai. I think she'll get the therapeutic help she needs from someone who believes in crystals. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Actually Ojai is the perfect place for them.
Yeah, she'll like learn how to like groom horses.
Dressage.
Yeah, it'll be like, I'm not really good at working with people without manipulating them and using them, so I've animals. Become a veterinarian.
But horses without a whip are pretty much manipulation free.
Well, so final thoughts, everybody.
Man.
What do you, you know, we've seen this movie again, 13, now in 2019. How do we feel about it?
I liked it. I thought the acting was amazing. The shots were amazing. It was really like true and vulnerable way of showing those teenage years. But it was very scary to watch now as a 32-year-old and remember how much I identified with it as a 16-year-old. I was like, oh, wow, that's not a good sign, maybe. But I thought it was really an amazing piece of art. Maybe not something to watch when you're already depressed. Like watch it when you have something fun to do the next day, I think would be a good tip.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just pulling up a couple notes, but I think good acting all around from Holly Hunter, Evan Rachel Wood, Nikki Reed, and Jeremy Sisto. This was super uncomfortable to watch as an adult. Yeah. There were so many moments where I just felt queasy, and I was like, oh, man, like, this is a terrible scenario, because I could telegraph how poorly these decisions were going to play out. So queasy was definitely, like, an overriding feeling I had. I also thought about codependency while watching this, and having toxic friends and making sure that you set up your own boundaries, because Holly didn't have any boundary, or rather Mel, the mom, didn't have boundaries in the house. Tracy didn't have boundaries, and Evie is the type of person that exploits not having strong boundaries for yourself. This movie also felt like birth control, you know. After watching it, I 100% at that moment for the next day was like, no daughters.
Yeah.
Can't do it. Can't have it.
Exactly what I thought.
Yeah. And
what?
No.
What? No. Daughters are the best. You get over it super early on. Like, then they
sure.
become like fully formed adults so much earlier, and you can actually have real conversations with them.
That's the scary
and they don't
part.
Live in your they don't live in your basement till they're 32, you know? Like, they are.
Yeah, this 13 is Clockwork Orange for teenage girls. And
yeah.
No, but I did think, well, you know, whatever. We all have different thoughts about this, but I did think, man.
I don't think we do.
This is birth control. I would give this movie, though, a 9 Hot Topic bracelets,
nice.
Stolen out of 10. Mm-hmm. If you're ready to watch a really brutal film about growing up. And I do think that movies like this are a perfect counterweight for films like Superbad,
yeah.
which kind of more glorify and romanticize this
yeah.
period of adolescence.
It's like the Canadian version of 13.
And this movie, you know, it's partially a Just Say No commercial, but it's cool to see, we watched The Craft, we've watched Mean Girls. It's cool to see another different version of a girl's coming of age story.
It's like a cross between Mean Girls and Heathers almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right on board with that rating. It held. I watched it at 23, I think, was the one, or 22, whatever, how old I was when it came out. It was almost the exact same movie. I was able to appreciate a little more of the acting more, and you know, this go around at being an older person now, middle aged. But it was exactly as uncomfortable and as like poignant as I thought it was, and made me nostalgic for being like a teenager, pretty appreciative of a more stable upbringing than a lot of people are afforded, which is good. And it's just, you know. More of an empathy for the addicts in the film too. The older I get now, just you know, seeing how life works.
Yeah,
opened up a lot of dialogue for this one. A lot of really good dialogue too, just to talk about in the film. I mean, everyone can relate on some level to any of this. So it's just a really well done piece of art. Is a great way to describe it. I mean, that's what this is. It's a film, a movie. It's a piece of performance art. Really, you're dropping these characters in this place. Really well done. I give it, I'm giving it 9 out of 10, mildly infected belly button piercings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a lot.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Amber, for picking 13 for us to watch. I had a great time doing this. Where can people find you once again?
Oh, you can find everything that I'm doing on my website, amberollo.com, amberollo.com. And at the end of January, last week in January, I'm doing a week at the Creek. If you want to hear some orphan jokes, I'm like a good orphan, so less, more hero, less villain. You can go either way as an orphan.
So you're Annie.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't call myself a hero. I'm just kidding. But yeah.
Look, orphans are either Evie or Annie. Yeah. I like that.
But yeah, I would love to see some of you out there.
Yeah, right on. Well, this has been another episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. As always, I'm Gabe Pacheco, and you can find me and everything I'm doing at GabePacheco.com. And you can come see live stand-up comedy at Cantina Royal every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Funhouse Comedy. I host that.
Great show.
And Sammy, you have anything for us?
I just want everyone to rate, review, and subscribe. Tell us what you like.
Yeah.
Follow us on social media.
Send us messages. Give us suggestions for films that you'd like us to cover. All right. We love you. Have a wonderful holiday
love you.
Season.
Love you. I love you.
Now take the fall for me. Bye.